It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff, Gina, and Kevin Marks join us to talk about the latest from the Google Oracle contest. There's some good news. Turns out the judge knows how to write software. That's next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 147, recorded May 16th, 2012. Safe Harbors. This Week in Google is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com now. Click the radio microphone and use the offer code TWIG. And by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings and billing clarity for mobile phone service. Ting is running a Dump Your Contract contest and will buy out one winner's mobile service contract every day for the month of May. Go to ting.com/DYC to enter. And by GoToMyPC from Citrix. GoToMyPC connects you directly to your Office Mac or PC from any other computer or your iPad or iPhone. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today at GoToMyPC.com. Click the Try It Free button and use the offer code TWIG. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. It's really This Week in 4G as we go around the world on This Week in Google. Let's start with all the way over to the far left, which is Kevin Marks. He's in Seattle at a privacy conference right now. Kevin,
that's right. I'm at Privacy Identity Innovation, which is it's one of those conferences where different groups of people meet. So there's tech people, there's lawyers, and there's like legislative people, as you know, lawmakers as well. So
that's cool.
It's an interesting one. It's quite fun.
Kevin works, of course, at Salesforce, but he's an advocate of open standards. And were you involved in OAuth?
I was peripherally involved in OAuth.
Okay.
I forwarded it to the internal security people at Google, and they jumped all over it. And then I was sort of on the mailing list and listening, but I don't pretend to understand security well enough to comment helpfully on some of that stuff. But I listen to the people and talk about it.
Authentication is a big part of not just identity, but security and privacy and all of that. Fascinating.
OAuth really is a breakthrough in this.
Yeah, yeah. He also hosts a great show about tunneling. Which is the name that the old Yiddish comics and performers used in the Catskills. The tumbler was kind of the social director, wasn't he, for those
yes.
Catskill hotels?
The one who got everyone to talk to each other and dance, yes.
Everyone needs a tumbler. We'll make Kevin our honorary tumbler. Now, look at this shot.
I think you're the tumbler here, Leo.
Look at this shot. From Sydney Harbor, Jeff Jarvis at BuzzMachine.com. If you're watching the video of this show, that is sunrise in Sydney. Thank you for joining us so early in the morning, Jeff.
My pleasure. I'll get better light of myself soon, but I thought I'd give you a nice view of the bridge.
We were earlier looking at the Opera House.
Across the harbor.
Wow.
And I don't think we can see the Opera House from here, not quite.
Here's the good news. For the first time ever, you don't look too pale. What are you doing in Sydney?
I'm at the Sydney Writers Conference, Writers Festival, where I was speaking a couple times, including it's about privacy and publicness this year. So that's why I'm doing it. And then I go on to Seoul next week.
This is so great. This is so fantastic.
Yeah, so we're missing you at PII, Jeff, because they were reminiscing about you coming last year or the year before when you...
I wish that was a very good conference. Good people. Really good people.
Well, yeah. We will definitely get a synopsis of both those conferences from you guys in just a second. I also want to introduce Gina Trapani, who, like me, is staying home this week.
Yeah, just living my boring life, sitting in my boring home office, but thrilled to be here as usual.
You should go to San Diego Harbor, then we can have an all-harbor session.
We could. All-harbor all the time. I'll just go out by the Petaluma River, which is actually only posing as a river. It's really a tidal slough, and it smells like one, I might add. Top story today. Glee mentions Chipotle.
Huge. I was so excited when that happened last night. I was like, oh, Now all we need is Gutenberg, Habermas, and Google.
If Glee ever mentions Gutenberg, then you know there's somebody in the screenwriting room who knows us. That yes. happens every once in a while. There have been comic books, there have been TV shows that have had little inside mentions of stuff on Twit. That's kind of like a little wink or a nudge. So it could be. You don't know.
If they ever mention Twig on Glee, I will explode.
Well, they won't
into a
do that.
Billion bits.
But we'll just know. Glee writer, anonymous Glee writer, will know if Gutenberg sneaks in.
Yeah.
Habermas. We'll know.
Or Habermas is a giveaway.
Habermas.
Oh, Habermas. I don't even know. Habermas. That'd be beautiful.
I still don't know who Habermas is. The only guy I've ever heard talk about it is this guy, Jeff Jarvis.
And I get in trouble for it every time.
Well, you shouldn't.
There was a fake Habermas Twitter account at one point.
What is it? He was a German philosopher? Is that who he was?
He's still alive.
He is.
He's alive.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. Chad, we've got our new producer, by the way, Chad Johnson on the board today. Eileen, as you know, has departed the building. But we'll be back on Monday for All About Android. Chad, let's book Habermas.
Let's book him. Let's get him on the show.
Wow. And if you do...
He's a recluse in Germany.
Recluse. We like him even better.
We'll make sure to send him a 4G card so he can
connect. Can remain reclusive. Wow.
There goes a vote behind me.
Here's the fake account.
Look at that. Look at this. This is the best looking twig ever. There's the Sydney Harbor comes to life behind Jeff Jarvis. So I don't know where to start here. There are a lot of stories. Matt Cutts, I will just give you right at the top, is going to be joining us for Triangulation this afternoon.
Yay.
Yeah,
great get.
4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern time. And he did a great little video. Well, actually, he's done many great little videos. And here is the mashup.
A fan mashup.
A fan mashup, not produced by Google. Of Matt Cutts, how to rank, let's just play this. I think we can play this. How to rank number one on Google with Matt Cutts.
Here. Hi, everybody. Hello. You know, anybody's welcome to show up. It's a party in here, so. Hi, everybody. Matt Cutts here. Wow, so many questions. We have a fun question today from a billion people
in the Philippines.
Matt, your webmaster help videos are a big success, and I think everybody loves them. Yay! It's a great help for webmasters. But if one wanted to rank number one, how would you go about doing this? You know, on what basis are the results ranked? Wow, really good question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that before. So, I know this answer.
That's just not right.
Poor guy.
So, very good question. I'm glad you asked this. Breast. Oof. That's a really interesting question. Oh, boy. Okay, keyword density. Let's talk about it a little bit. There's one recipe, and you can just follow that like, you know, baking cookies, and if you follow it to the letter, you'll rank number one. And that's just the way it works. Hey, that's pretty interesting. It's about that word. The next time you mention that word, oh, okay, it's still about that word. And once you start to mention it a whole lot, then that might help with your ranking. Absolutely. What is the ideal keyword density? The answer is 77%. Get the same phrase on the page as many times as possible. There's lots of different factors that would make you rank well, but fundamentally, in addition to keyword stuffing, we look at links to porn sites. Not many people tend to link that much to sites within the porn industry. That's the sort of thing that's going to be really rewarding for users. So, link to porn sites. Could it be annoying? Yes, it could be annoying. It might be really annoying, and that's perfectly fine. So another thing is you will rank higher because you run AdSense. It's definitely the case that you get some boost because you run AdSense. So I absolutely would recommend you run AdSense. That's a really nice feature. So, yeah, that would be an opportunity. So that's just some very quick advice about how to rank number one. And, you know, this made me feel really good. I go to bed at night sleeping relatively well, knowing that I'm trying to change the world. And I think that's fantastic. But also, you know, I do think that Bing or Blecko or DuckDuckGo are potentially doing illegal things like hacking sites. Let's take a step back and stop hating on everybody for a second. Peace out. Spread the love. Don't worry about it that much. And keep working on making your own website as good as you can.
Wow, Sam Applegate made that call.
Bravo. Kudos, Sam.
Yeah.
Yeah, kudos to Sam.
It has nothing to do with Google, and none of the advice is accurate. As far as I know.
For those of you listening, you can see all Matt's different haircuts, different weight loss stages.
At one point, he's completely shaven, bald on it.
Completely shaven during one of his 30-day deals.
Yeah.
So.
It's, you know what? I think that's adorable. Matt is such a great front man for Google and Google search. As you know, he's been on the show many times. He's in charge of fighting spam on Google's web results, search results. But he gives those great webmaster videos, and I think that's... Just pray no one does that for us. That's all I can say. Pray. Other top stories. Let's see. Where to begin today? I don't have anything to hang my hat on.
Yeah, nothing screams this week.
I'm pretty excited that I finally got ICS on my big phone, my Galaxy Note.
But you were an ICS hater before, I thought.
Well, I don't like a couple of things I didn't like about ICS are fixed in the version that Samsung pushed. Remember, this is Samsung's version, so it has TouchWiz and it has some new Samsung apps. But the couple of things I didn't like, I don't like the Nexus because it doesn't have buttons. And this, of course, this phone has physical buttons. Oh, yeah, I'll put it down here. You can see it. Which means, you know, you don't lose the menu button. So part of my complaint about ICS is that the buttons tend to, because they're all soft, they're all in software, they tend to be in different. The menu sometimes is here, sometimes is there. I think that's bad design. My other complaint about ICS was you were forced to have a Google, on the Nexus anyway, a Google search box taking up considerable amount of space, and on the bottom the icon row, so even on a big screen you lost a lot of real estate to forced Google content. That's not the case. This is once TouchWiz is running, it's pretty much identical to the Gingerbread version of this phone, except that it has now ICS running in the background, so the user interface is nicer on some of the apps and things like that. I think this is actually a good compromise. For instance, if I press and hold the home key, I now get the thing I think is completely useless, but some people like the task browser where you get the thumbnails of running applications, which aren't really running. And so you still get that ICS feature, but it's not taking up a whole button, really, right? I really don't like it that the home button does, or the recent button does that. So you still have a back button because that's a hardware back button. You still have a menu button because it's a hardware button. And those don't change even if you rotate. So I think that all in all, this is good. It feels a little sluggish on the Note, to be honest with you. I'm not sure if there's something I'm doing or if there's something that's going on with ICS on the Note. But it did seem to slow it down a little bit. So I don't know. There's nothing. That's not a story. That's just.
Not to jump ahead, but Apple is rumored to be going to a larger screen iPhone.
Yes.
Right? Is there some magic moment coming, some magic size, you think?
No.
No.
In fact, this is one of the reasons I like. There was a great chart of Android fragmentation. I'll pull it up and show it to you. This is one of the reasons I like Android fragmentation. More choices. So there is a sweet spot for every human. Very few people like the Galaxy Notes. Well, I shouldn't say that because I think it's selling quite well. But not everybody wants a 5.3-inch phone. Some people want a 3.5-inch phone like the iPhone. Some people want a 4-inch phone. And I think that's one of the nice things about Android is you have a choice. You don't have a choice right now in the iPhone. You only have 3.5 inches. That's it. Let me see. This is kind of a wild. This comes from there's some software that will let you, find Wi-Fi access points. Let me see if I can find this. It's... No. Open Signal Maps is an app on Android, this is from that app. Now this is going to be Android users who run Open Signal Maps, which is a way to find open Wi-Fi access points. So that's going to be kind of limited. But I think that this is an interesting. If you look at, for instance, these are all the different. That's talk about fragmentation. These are all the different Android models out there. And if you look at, I'm going to find the original article on Opens. This is from Boy Genius Report, but let me see if I can find the original.
I don't find, when I have a WarDrive, I don't find a single open network anymore.
Yeah,
Google,
I know.
Google managed to find a few on Street View, but that's pretty much it.
Open Signal Maps said there are 3,997 different Android devices running its app. There's one iPhone. Maybe no. There's got to be more because there's for old ones. So there's five iPhones or four iPhones, but there's 3,997 models of Android phones. And each one has its own display resolution, its own screen size, and all of that. It seems. So that's the negative. But I think it's also the positive that you have a choice.
Right, and you have an abstraction layer that actually works, which is the iOS. Everyone is now padding their apps with multiple different giant bitmaps to fit the multiple different screen sizes they've got there, because they've got four separate screen sizes in two rotations. So they end up with eight bitmaps because they're doing everything with bitmaps as opposed to doing it with layouts, which is
right,
a shame.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, Gina, you're a developer. You kind of know the pros and cons on both sides because your to-do text is on both Android and iPhones, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, the nice thing about the way Android is structured is what Kevin said, is that you design screens with relative layouts, similar to the way that you design web
just
pages.
Just like the web, right.
Yeah, so if you expand the size of the screen, the screen can fill it, right, a certain way. And that's why on Android, you know, apps that run, you know, on the small handset that don't have crazy graphics, that aren't games that have, you know, extreme graphics, can just expand to fill the screen. That's really nice. Because I have one app on Android. It runs on every, you know, right, on the big screen and the small screen. You know, on iPhone, like Kevin said, you design straight to the screen. The small screen and the Retina display, and then the big screen and the Retina display, and it's different resolutions, different graphics. So, you know, on one side you get maybe design that's, you know, you're more sure that it's going to work everywhere, but at the same time, it's, you know, you get a lot of apps that you have to, you know, increase to 2x size, or, you know, you have that problem that we've talked about before where you're running iPhone apps on a small screen. You know, the fragmentation, it's a double-edged sword, right? It's like consumer choice and apps that are relative layout, but at the same time, for a developer, you know, it's not clear. It's like, what should I develop to? You know, every month you kind of have to check the charts. Okay, what version should I develop to? You know, how many emulators do I have to run? You know, right. I've got in my Android development setup, I've got, you know, a list of 10 different emulators and screen sizes that I want to launch my app in and test in. So it makes it more complicated.
And it's not just screen size. It's also API and OS version, right?
That's absolutely. And it's whether or not there's a keyboard, a hard keyboard or a soft keyboard. Right. I mean, there's a lot of different variables.
Now, let me temper that number, 3,997. Part of that is because every custom ROM kind of identifies differently. So there, of the 3,997 devices, 1,363 appear only once. So you could probably take those off the list.
Yeah.
But there are thousands. The Samsung brand is a clear winner, 40% of the market.
Wow.
40%, then HTC. But this is where it gets challenging for the developer. This is the API level, and it goes everywhere from Android 1.6 to Android 3.0.
Yeah, that's what gets
to 3.2.
Difficult.
It gets very difficult. And then this is the resolution scatter chart, which is all over the place.
Yeah, these are some incredible charts. I mean, you know, as a developer, you pick out the biggest slices of the pie and you develop to those.
Right.
But that stinks because then you have users who write and say, hey, I've got this crazy model at this, you know, strange screen size that three other people have, and I can't run your app, you know, and that's hard.
Here's a great one. This is a graphic that shows the various variations in screen size on Android. And then I'll scroll down, and this is Apple. In Apple, there's four lines. So, but I don't, you know, I think I hate to say fragmentation. That's a loaded word. I like to use the word choice.
I agree. I don't
Diversity.
Think that developers don't
Diversity.
Matter. Users matter. Yeah, users matter, right? Like, to me, it's like making life harder on developers for the sake of giving users more choice. Like, that's the right balance.
Right.
You know, as a developer, I'm not going to blame these companies for making my life harder. My life, that's my job. Right. If it's harder, if it's a little bit harder for me to develop for more users, then like, so be it. I mean, of course, there are ways to get around this with better development tools and that kind of thing. And Google, you know, has a long way to go with that. But we should always err on the side of giving the users a better experience. And you know, it's arguable whether or not a lot of choice, the paradox of choice, is a better experience. We could have that conversation. But definitely, you know, better for developers versus better for users. We should always err on the side of better for users.
Now, Fred Flintstone in our chat room, who is an iOS developer, says, no, there is screen layout support on iOS.
there is some way of handling a variety of orientations and resolutions. I'm not familiar with it, so I don't know. I have to defer
there's,
to
well, there's interface builder springs and layouts things, but it's right. It's not quite as flexible as the Android one.
Interface builder, yeah.
Yeah, it's not definitely not as flexible as Android.
Yeah. Android will just kind of flow it. It's what we call on the website. They call it, what do they call it? Adaptive resizing. There's a word for it because you don't know.
Responsive design is what you
call it. Responsive design. Because you don't know, not only do you not know what the resolution, but you don't know how big the window is or how wide it's going to be. You don't know right. anything about it.
So no, I run my browser narrowed with a right. Echo font down the side, and too many sites don't cope with my browser being slightly narrower than 1024 and give me horizontal scroll bars, which is really stupid.
Well, I want you to, when we get our new Tech Guy site up, which is supposed to be responsive, Lullabot's really good. I'm going to say, hey, Kevin, how's it look on your browser? Not that you'd ever listen to the radio show, but just give us a little feedback on that would be very valuable. So I thought that was kind of an interesting graphic. I like that. Now, get ready, because here comes Android 5.0. We're currently at 4, which is Ice Cream Sandwich, and Jelly Bean is next. And according to a report in the Wall Street Journal, Jelly Bean will be deployed not on a single Nexus smartphone, as they have done up to now, but on perhaps as many as 5 models this fall. Welcome to diversity. they're all named Nexus. Last month, Google began selling an unlocked variation of the Galaxy Nexus, which runs Android 4 for $400 via Google Play. I didn't know that. They went back to selling their own version. That was something they did with the Nexus 1 and then pulled back. So maybe they will start doing that again, doing their own channel. I didn't even realize they had done that again. Yeah, look at that. You can buy it. $400 for the Galaxy Nexus. I don't think the Galaxy Nexus was at any point, maybe briefly, the best Android phone out there, but it's not close now. There's the HTC One. There's the Galaxy S2, which I thought was better. There's the Note, depending on what you need. But at least there's a vanilla experience for people who want it.
There's a great scene in a recent episode of Mad Men where they're like going in to pitch a client with 2 different ideas, and Don leaves one of the ideas in the cab and just pitches them one. And later on, one of his people says to him, why did you drop off that other idea? Why didn't you pitch them both? And he said, I picked one idea and I went with one idea, because when you go with more than one, it's weak.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's very much the Apple way, right? Like, we're going to give you what we think is the best for you. And, you know, you accept it or you don't. Whereas this is the other way around, where it's like, let the customer choose.
Steve Jobs always said, you have a choice. Use Apple or not. That's your choice. And if you choose Apple, we'll choose the rest. We'll take care of the rest. And then, you know what? It's interesting, because I think you and I, Gina, fall in that other camp. We want the choice. We like the idea of having a more open platform. But there, obviously, the market has told us, it shows us that a lot of people want to have everything done
just
for them.
Just hand to them. I like thinking about your users and your customers as smart people who know what they want.
Me
and
too.
That it's not always the same. I don't think that there's a one-size-fits-all. I never believe that there's a one true way. I think that there are some people who feel very strongly they want a hard keyboard, and some people who want a bigger screen. And I for me, it's a matter of like treating your customers like they're smart people. The way that you treat your viewers, like they're a smart audience. You know, I think saying I know better than you is there's a level of arrogance there that it's just not my way.
And yet, P.T. Barnum said you never went broke underestimating the American public.
Well,
right?
Yeah. Yep.
Look at this. Sun's coming out in Sydney Harbor, and Jeff's still freezing.
No, it's not that bad. It's just breezy, and I'm causing noise, I know.
No, we like it. Just stay where you are. The more you move, the worse your audio is, because it breaks up. That's just such a beautiful view. Beautiful view. Jeff's still an iPhone user. We pick on him.
Hey.
We tried. Actually, I am too. I carry both. In fact, you know what? Something happened. I don't know if this is, I'd love to know if anybody in our audience has had this happen. All of a sudden, Google Voice is going right through for some people who call me. Some people can get through. Others go right to voicemail. And there's no apparent setting in Google Voice. I mean, I know that that's a setting where you could say, go right through. I turned off the spam filter. And it's, and so, unfortunately, it's my kids who can't call me. So I have to carry an iPhone so they can continue to call me. I know.
Oh, that's not good.
I know. Very frustrating.
If anybody... At least it's not a BlackBerry, Leo.
Yeah. Hey, kids, call me on the BlackBerry. I just can't, I can't figure, don't show this, Chad, because it's got all my phone numbers on it, but I can't figure out why it's bouncing only calls from certain numbers.
I wonder if they got interconnect problems, because they do explicitly block some exchanges with Google Voice, because they're the ones that...
are spammers?
They're the ones that offer free conference call stuff, because they are rural exchanges that get large amount of cross payments from other ones.
Well, yeah, I mean,
there's some weird interconnect rules in telco.
Maybe that's it. There's a nice spam filtering checkbox, which sends calls and text messages from numbers identified as spam by Google directly to the spam folder. So that one I turned off. That didn't seem to make any difference. I just wonder if there's a... I think it feels like there's a bug. It happened all of a sudden. I bet it goes away. MXX says his dad, who's on Sprint, always gets forwarded to voicemail. So maybe there is something going on. Maybe there's a little something. And Lance, a sideman in the chat room, we love the folks who watch live. Thank you. Say, no, it's
you're
not
here.
It's not he's got a link to a talk support note, but this isn't it. This isn't it.
Answer.py.
It is. It's exact. It is. It's answer.py.
It is answer.py.
It's answer.py. That means it's a Python script. We love their Python script support. We're going to take a break, come back with more. Jeff Jarvis is in Sydney Harbor. Well, not in the harbor. He's on the edge of Sydney.
That may come next.
Where the sun is coming up. BuzzMachine.com is his blog. His new book is Public Parts. He is, in fact, talking about privacy and publicness in Sydney for a writer for writers. Is that right? It's for writers?
It's a writers' festival. We're just having so much fun, we writers. We get together and you don't know the fun we have, we writers.
Do you get to wear a tweed coat with patches and smoke a pipe? Because that's what I want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also with us, Kevin Marks, who's at a privacy and identity conference in Seattle. He would have a view of the harbor, but we told him to go inside.
I know. I've got to stay. If I go look that way, I can see the Space Needle, I think.
We almost had a two-harbor view. That would have been something. And Gina Trapani, who's indoors, and she's a blogger at smarterware.org. We're brought to you today by stamps.com. We love to talk about solutions that make your life easier. Stamps.com is a really good example. Never go to the post office again. How do you like that? Because you can do it all from your computer, Mac or PC, and stamps.com. I love this solution. Stamps without any, you don't need a postage meter. You don't need special ink or anything. Just your regular everyday printer. They even will give you a USB scale that you put into your computer. And then you just throw what you want to mail on there. And you always have exactly, precisely the right postage. You don't waste a penny. Now, see that $110 value? Now, you won't see that special deal if you just go to stamps.com. You've got to go to stamps.com and click the radio microphone in the upper right-hand corner. See that? And then you'll get the special deal when you use the offer code TWIG, T-W-I-G. You'll get $55 in postage coupons, the digital scale, a supply kit, and a four-week trial. All you have to do is use our offer code TWIG. This is a great way to find out if stamps.com is right for you. I'll tell you, if you are an Amazon or eBay seller, you've got to use stamps.com. It automatically fills out the forms, prints the postage directly from eBay or Amazon. With all the information they know, they give you discounts you cannot get at the post office, up to 21% on express mail shipping, priority mail up to 15% discounts. I mean, these are good things. It's a really great deal. They even have no monthly fee, no service fee for high volume shippers. So if you're if you use a lot of U.S. Postal Service, you really ought to be doing this. You're crazy if you don't do this. Stamps.com. Use the offer code TWIG to get started with that $110 no-risk trial. We use it here like crazy. I think we got several accounts, actually. So Bing.com's going straight after Google and everybody else with their new social search. And the idea All right, here we go. In fact, I could show you. Do you want to go on the tour? Because I got it. It got turned on for me yesterday.
Yeah, let's look.
Let's tour the new Bing. So you'll see on the right-hand side, because I'm logged in, friends who might know, I'm searching for movies, friends who might have something to say about movies. You could add your own comments here. Ask friends what they think. Choose the friends you want to ask, then write a comment to get their ideas. I'm thinking about seeing the new Avengers movie, but I just want to know, is Diana Rigg in it? And then you should type that just to see what people say.
That is actually what I thought when I saw that.
Yeah, I was very disappointed.
I was hoping for a Joss Whedon reboot of that.
Joss, come on. Emma Peel, John Steed, together again, fighting crime in a cat jumpsuit. Okay, so you can do that. You can show friends what you found, add results you found from this and other searches. There's a little button, a little link button. Let your friends see what you're thinking about. Share your search on Facebook. Yeah, I just searched for herpes. Would you like to join me? Okay, not all your searches are probably appropriate for sharing on Facebook. But so now this is of course better if you search for things like movies or music. It'll you know give you more information. If you search for Jeff Jarvis, let me see. I just had a curiosity.
And herpes? No.
No, look at M.G. Siegler posted, Rafe Needleman posted, but it doesn't seem to be related. Rafe's looking for an Audi A3 with the sequential automatic transmission, and Robert Scoble says, ha, this is one way to get me to try Bing. Google has locked me out. Oh, that's nice.
So these are all the tech journalists who are trying out Bing.
No one else is using it except my three friends who are tech journalists. Actually, I don't have any.
We've got access so far.
I don't have any normal friends. That's why. Yeah. So this is interesting.
How is this different than Search Plus Your World? You sign into Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah. Because Search Plus Your World uses just G+.
Yeah.
So that's the biggest difference.
Mm-hmm. You can sign into Windows Live too if you want to.
Yeah, I have both.
So is this going to have a problem like the social news reader that people are going to get freaked on Facebook when they see their searches? They forget that they signed in for it and suddenly the herpes search is out there?
I think you have to explicitly say, I'm searching for genital warts. Would you like to join me? And then it will... I'm sorry, folks. You didn't deserve that. Now, what's interesting is that there are three columns now in search, and the ad column is front and center, really, because it's the middle column, which typically, right, is the content column.
Right.
So.
It is? Oh, I'm not seeing that on mine.
Oh, I am. Look at this screen. Here's my browser. Search for Jeff Jarvis. Yeah, it's you've got that narrow. It's responsive. So I have on the left, I have search results. On the right, I have social activity. And by the way, I have added my Windows Live account as well as my Facebook account. You know what I haven't joined? Because it just seems so downmarket. Bing Rewards. The more you search, the more you win. It's like SNH.
What was that old search engine that did that? Gave away $1 million, supposedly.
Oh, yeah. Was it Ask.com that did that?
No. There's another one. The whole shtick was that you search there to earn money.
Right, right. Every click makes you money.
It was one of those things that was going to take over the web.
I'm kind of surprised that Microsoft would do that. It feels like green stamps.
Cheesy.
It's kind of cheesy. And by the way, we all have the same number of reward points. I have 24. In our chat room, somebody has 23. And I'm not even signed in. So I guess they just give you some default number. But see, right in the middle there is... the search. Now, the ads for Jeff Jarvis are, you'll like this, discountbooksale.com offering what would Google do?
I was fearing the Viagra ad.
At a low, low price. Low prices on Jeff Jarvis. Qualified orders over $25 ship free. We found Jeff Jarvis at peoplesmart.com. These are the junk ads that you get whenever you search for a person name.
See, the problem is Google would know me better, and there would be Viagra ads there.
Shall we compare it? I'm just curious. I don't think there are ads on your Jeff Jarvis.
I doubt nobody buys Jeff Jarvis.
Right. Well, nobody bought. I guess somebody buys just personal names, right? Yeah, there's no ads on Jeff Jarvis on Google. You're ad free.
Hoo, hoo, hoo.
Mm. I hate it when you search for a person's name and you get those ads for My Life and USA People Search and all that crap.
Yeah.
I think that's really bad.
Yeah, it's full of crap.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I searched for you, Leo, and it points out that you tweet, and it gave me a link to your Twitter account.
That's good.
And I searched for myself, and it said Gina's on Google Plus and gave a link, to, gave information.
Now that's very interesting.
So I think that's the key difference between this and Search Plus Your World is
it's
that
agnostic.
You can not only, yeah, it's agnostic. Not only can you sign in with both Facebook or Windows Live, but it's returning results from Twitter, Google Plus. I mean, it's returning results from competitors. Of course, the underdog, you know, is kind of going to do this, right? Yeah.
So this is interesting. I searched for myself. Paul Theroux has photos of Leo Laporte. Connect with Facebook so you and your friends can each. Wow. And then it has my Twitter account. Wow. Very interesting. Let me connect with Facebook and see. Okay, I'm now allowing Bing to post on my behalf. That's always scary.
Don't you love that?
Yeah. Now I see that Trey has posted pictures of me, Paul, Sarah Lane. Oh, dear. It says Sarah Lane has a photo of Leo Laporte. I probably don't want to see that. That scares you, doesn't it? I know what you did last night. Oh, my God. These are weird. Okay. Let's not click
so
that.
So when you get that DM saying, there are these weird photos of you on Twitter.
Yeah. When you get that on Facebook, it usually is a virus saying, I know what you did last night, and I have video to prove it, and then they get you.
But for you, it's always true. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, there is video.
There's no virus, Leo.
So what do you think? How does Bing steal market share from Google? This?
You know, my fear is that both, you know, it'll have some Google stuff later. I think this goes back to your argument before. Search is now getting very cluttered. It's like Yahoo takes over the world.
God, that's a depressing
thought. They're adding more stuff on, right. Trying to make you say, oh, ours is better, but no, ours is better. We have free jalapeno peppers on our search.
Ugh. Do any of you have the new Google knowledge graph stuff showing up yet?
How do you get that? So this is the technology is being used to provide popular facts about people, places, and things alongside Google's traditional results.
I mean, basically it looks like a Wikipedia box, but there may be a bit more to it than that.
Yeah.
Or the baseball card, the digital age.
I like this idea. Knowledge graph flows into new units. They have no official name. So Danny Sullivan, writing on Search Engine Land, says he calls them knowledge panels. They don't always appear, only showing up when Google deems them relevant. I think this does not bother me, but you're right. It is cluttering, right?
That's the only thing. Yeah, it's just I'm afraid we're going to get into a war. And the whole world is going to look like Yahoo. And you know what happened to Yahoo, folks?
Right. Google says it's compiled. Go ahead.
I think Google's A/B testing will be fully fairly good at making them the right size. That's that kind of optimization they're good at.
All right. I'm going to search.
Now QQ Leo complained about the addition of Google Plus to search.
Yeah, I wasn't too happy about it. So I guess I'm not getting it because I searched for a movie star and that would be what you'd get. So they say they've compiled 3.5 billion facts, information about and relationships between 500 million objects or entities. Entities are persons, places, or things.
So I'm assuming this is the Freebase stuff, but...
What is Freebase? Is that an acquisition that Google made?
Yes. So it was a semantic mesh, basically, of information like that. A lot of it is based on Wikipedia. A lot of these like semantic things end up being useful crawls of Wikipedia.
Right. Do you think that's a potential?
But it's still an open source project. I think Microsoft is using the same data set for their stuff.
Do you think that's a potential problem? Because what it's kind of doing is putting Wikipedia information on the web without really highlighting it's from Wikipedia. And I know there's a lot of schools and people who say, you're not allowed to use Wikipedia information because, I mean, I trust Wikipedia, but it is, you know, you're not allowed to use it in a lot of schools, for instance. And this is kind of
it's
crypto Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's true. But it's not just using the information. As Kevin says, it's what it's really first trying to do is to recognize entities. Daylife.
Yeah.
Has a very smart engine doing that as well. We're full disclosure, I'm a partner. But what they want to know is the entity. So that once you know the entities, then you can say, aha, well, here's all the stuff we know about that entity, and here's the relationships of that entity to other entities, and here's patterns among the entities.
So did you get that, Chad? So Chad's turned on.
Oh, yeah, that's Pitt. That's it.
So Chad, we know a lot about you. You searched Brad Pitt as your default here?
Well, I searched bicycle and nothing came up. So.
Search for Habermas.
Harbor bus?
Habermas. Don't worry about it. It's an inside joke.
No, it should find Habermas. That is a good test. I should find it. It
will not find Habermas.
Now, one thing that I did was I signed out of my apps account and signed into my Gmail account. So if you're signed into apps, it may not be available. Mm-hmm.
Now, in Docs now you have this, too. So if I type Brad Pitt in a doc, I can right-click on it.
So try Leo Laporte.
Well, see, I think I don't have it turned on. Are you in Docs? Yeah.
Once again, that's in apps. You're using Google Apps as twit.tv. So if you sign out, you'll get it.
Do an incognito window.
Oh, an incognito window. Because I switched and it didn't help.
Yeah, it's not working for me, so... But if it's turned on for your IP range, it might work, yeah.
Okay.
Well, Chad got it. So I
turned it on over here. Let me get to the correct thing. And so we are in this is the TwitCraft doc. And so you turned on research over here.
Oh, it's now a bar, a column on the document.
Exactly. So maybe I wanted a quote that started with Minecraft. And let's see. No quotes with Minecraft. Let's not do that. Let's say Google. search everything instead. Okay, now we have, and this is very small, so that's...
So did you sign out of all account, like all
no,
Google?
No, I did the double sign-in, okay. where if you scroll back up here...
Your sign-in is I'm signed in either of those,
so
right.
there's my other email address, and here's the apps account. So like Google Apps for Business. Now, this doesn't seem very relevant. I don't know how I guess I'd insert this link into... Could I drag it over? I guess I'd cite this. I mean, this seems... Now it's added a little one over here.
Yeah, and then I put the footnote.
Yeah.
Look at that. So describe, because people are listening as well as watching.
Right. So there's this little bar on the side, and so let's search for something more relevant.
It's not so little, by the way. It's a fairly wide column.
Let's say architecture. And I'm butchering architecture.
ARC. Oh, that worked. Look at that.
Perfect. So,
Wikipedia is the first result.
Right.
But there's other stuff like.
But say in this document, this is man. I really want to use that. That's what I want in my thing. So
you
let's
just drag it into
drag
docs.
That in.
Mm. So he dragged an image of the Parthenon in or whatever.
Right. And then it cited it already. So
I'm jealous that you're getting it and I'm not. I want.
That's why I hired him.
What?
The doc stuff is separate though. You can everybody
can turn
should
that
be able
on.
To,
right.
Yeah, you can turn that on.
Where do we turn that on? Is there a setting?
In the tools menu, there's an item in called research or
I don't
research,
see it.
I think.
No.
It has to be in a
When you join a doc, you do Control Alt R.
Okay, right.
And that
right.
brings up the
it's
research
a keyboard
tab.
Control R.
But once again, I don't think it works for Google Apps yet.
Maybe it doesn't work in Safari, which I'm using. So, okay. Okay. This is kind of, I guess, I think this is cool. You know who this is? Strikes me who this might be for is tablet users who don't have Windows. Because one of the issues, you know, a lot of schools are looking at using, say, an iPad in school. But the problem I have is I'm doing research. I'm doing a report. All right, maybe I bought a keyboard because typing on glass is bad. That's problem number one. But then the other problem is I'm not windowed. So I'm writing, and then I have to go to another full screen to see something. Well, what if I were writing in a Google Doc and I had a research bar on the right? That would make it a lot easier, wouldn't it, on a tablet? I don't know if that's...
Well, I guess it also tries to... Google wants to give you answers to any question, anytime, for any need.
Anywhere.
So when you're writing a letter or anything, the idea is get your answer right here, right now.
By the way, if you're using Chrome, version 19 should have been pushed to you in the last few hours or days, and you will get something very interesting that is definitely a geek feature, tab syncing.
Yay!
Yes.
Did I tell you it was a geek feature? Tab syncing. What does that mean? I don't understand. Gina, what are we talking about here?
So if you turn on tab syncing and you're running Chrome on, say, your Android handset, and you when you launch Chrome on your Android handset, you can say, show me all the devices that have Chrome open.
Yeah.
You can switch to a different device and open up any one of the tabs, say, that's open on your computer.
So that doesn't open 48 tabs on my Android phone.
No, it doesn't.
That would be untenable.
Okay. It would be untenable. It just says, hey, here's the name of your computer. It's got tabs open. Here's a list of the tabs that are open, and you can just tap one and open it.
Cool.
Weren't they supposed to be able to do that like five versions ago, that you were supposed to have the tabs go across, and it never worked for me?
It's been in the beta. This tab sync has been in the Chrome beta for a while, but it just got released to the stable. Like, it's the stable version 19. And there's been syncing from Chrome to Chrome on desktops, but I think this is the first time it's, correct me if I'm mistaken, chat room, I think this is the first time it's going to Chrome on Android.
I could never get it to work on desktop to desktop. That's just me. I can't get Wi-Fi to work, so.
And would it be in my Chrome settings that I would enable this, or is it just enabled by default?
Yeah, no, it's not enabled by default. I had to turn it on. It's in, if you click on the wrench and go to settings, and then it's in, it's the advanced sync settings button. And then you have to
be logged in
off.
To Chrome as your Gmail account as well.
Yes, yeah, so at the top of the page, Leo, on the right, advanced sync settings.
Okay.
Scroll up. Yeah, advanced sync settings.
Okay. Oh, there it is. I'm signed in as Leah. Okay, now my advanced sync everything, encrypted data types.
Oh, look, you don't have it.
I don't have it, even though I did check, and I am on Chrome 19.
That checkbox is right below themes.
It's one more item in that checkbox.
Yeah, I guess
this
it's
is
going
Chrome slow. 19. Chrome is up to date.
Wacky.
Wacky is right.
They're holding out on us, Google, today.
Bastards.
They're like, quit, blacklist.
You know what? That's what it is. Except for Chad. Chad, I bet you have it.
I'm not signed in on this computer.
Oh, all right. Yeah, we don't want to. Yeah, that's a public computer, so we don't want to sign in there. Huh. Maybe you have to be on the Google Plus suggested user list before that.
Oh.
I'm off it, by the way. I'm off it.
Oh, you see, you should never have complained.
They dump me. I never complained.
What?
But they dump me.
He's not a technology person? Kick him off. Yeah. Kick him off.
That syncing is apparently rolling out slowly. And because I had it, I just assumed that it was out to a lot of people. But
well, let me see. How would I know if it's on Android? Because it is supposed to be an ice cream sandwich. So when I launch the browser, which is not Chrome, by the way, on Android.
So this is the thing. You have to be running the Chrome beta on Android.
Ah.
Yeah. So this is
not
yeah,
in the browser. It's in the Chrome browser.
Right.
Right.
Can
right.
I get that from the Play Store?
The Play Store. Yep.
Doesn't that sound stupid? Just saying that the Play Store. I'm gonna go look in the Play Store.
You're not gonna get yourself back on that list.
I know.
Talking like that.
I love Matt Cutts. All right. I'm gonna go look on the Play Store. Chrome beta. At least it's free. And then so I would be able to then turn it on the Chrome beta.
Yeah, and then you'd be able to see. You'd be able to say there's a button. I think it's in the menu. It says request a desktop site.
So that's kind of cool. So that's kind of the next step of Chrome to phone, which has always been around as an extension where you could send to your phone any page you were looking at. Now, if you just leave it open in Chrome, you'll be able to pick anything, any tab you've got open on your desktop.
Yeah, which sounds pretty geeky, but the point in the future when Chrome is Android's default browser and this all just sort of happens in the background, if you're reading something on your computer and you got to dash off to the dentist, you know, looking at it in the waiting room, it's a really nice feature.
Now, what if? So, I mean, this is a way of Google getting everybody to just use Chrome everywhere. This is smart. This is the kind of thing Apple does. Although Apple doesn't do it. I mean, and I wonder if people would get upset if Apple did this.
Right. I think Apple assumes that they're different experiences and you don't want to merge them.
Ah.
That's a very different approach. You know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Why would you want to do that, they're saying?
Yeah.
It is a geeky... I'd have to say it's a geeky feature. But, I don't think most people care whether they can do that, but I think the geeks who use tabs like crazy, I've never understood it, but if you ask a geek, anybody on any of these shows, how many tabs do you have open, Gina? Dozens.
As always, too many to read the title bar. Yes, a lot of tabs.
Yeah, they're
it's a sign of optimism in life. I'll get to that later.
Aha!
Yes.
That's exactly what it is. Oh, I'm going to read that. Oh, yeah, definitely want to keep that around. I'm never close. Oh, yeah. It's the same people who have it's hoarders. It's digital hoarders.
Hey.
Pretty soon you're not going to be able to walk down the hall in your house because it's full of magazines. Except nowadays it's just bits. Now it's just bits.
That was one of the conversations at the Privacy Identity conference was discussing about whether you should design to minimize retained data. And the comment was, well, engineers are hoarders. They keep everything. They just log it all.
Right.
And you have to explicitly go and find them and get them to delete it. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's kind of true. We sort of log everything.
Well, because bits don't take any space, so why not?
Well, we've got space to store all this stuff. And, and later on, you may want to debug that and know what's going on.
And you don't know the value in it. You can't predict the value today of what that data, what the anomalies will show you tomorrow.
Yeah, but I'm going to give you Leo's law. The more stuff you hoard, the less value it has because you can't find anything.
Not data. You have Google, this is the whole point of Google's worldview is we'll fix that for you.
Ah. We can
save
find it
all.
It's in there somewhere.
Yeah.
It's like Gordon Bell, who was wearing the former digital equipment guy who went on to be Microsoft fella and wears a camera around his neck that takes pictures every few seconds of everything he does. And he says, I'm not going to worry about that. Someday I'll need that. He just has pictures of everywhere he's been, everybody he's talked to. And what you're waiting for is the technology to catch up to do all the face recognition, for instance, and say, oh, yeah, you had a meeting with Kevin on Friday and you did this and talked about that.
But the other thing I do in Gmail is I will see an email on my phone or whatever, and then I'll mark it as unread, believing that it will come back up with the list somehow magically, and I will then deal with it later.
Instead,
what happens is 3 weeks later, somebody says, did you get my email? And I have to, they can see my eyes roll as I have this vague memory.
I dimly read it. I read it at one point. I handled it. Yeah, this is, you hit the nail on the head, Jeff.
It's my giant pool of stars.
Yes.
The inbox is full of stars.
It is a form of optimism.
I have more stars than the universe has.
You're all jolly, jolly people who think the world is a good place. And someday there'll be an infinite amount of time to go through your stars.
Yeah.
Wow. I like that slant on it. We're going to take a break. We're talking about the Google. This Week in Google is on the air. Jeff, Gina, and our guest today, Kevin Marks. I want to ask you about PII in a second, Kevin, and what's going on. What's the latest in privacy and identity? But first, let's talk Ting. Why would a service, asks Ting, treat its best customers like criminals? Oh, you're talking about cell phone industry, aren't you? Where the you can never get out of it, right? You join it, and for 2 years they own your, I want to say, you know what, but they own your tuchus. Ting is totally reinventing the cell business. Now, Ting is using Sprint, so if you've got good Sprint coverage where you are, Ting is going to be every bit as good as Sprint. They have great phones. But unlike everybody else, they have fees that are fair, honest, and out there, forthright. They believe in full disclosure. And they never, penalize you for using more than you said you would. They refund you for minutes, text messages, or data that you didn't use. There is never an early termination fee. Everything is month to month. Oh, I love this. You love your Netcast. How about your phone company? Ting welcomes Twig listeners. I love that. That is really cool. I love these guys. They're doing a contest for May, the Dump Your Contract contest. They'll buy out one winner's mobile service every day this month and sign you up for Ting. Ting.com/DYC. They'll cut you a check to pay your early termination fee from anywhere from $100 to $300. Ting.com/DYC. You could share your contract termination horror stories and follow contest winners on Facebook. I love that. And you can enter every day to win. So simple, honest, fair pricing. You pay for just what you use. Let's go to the plans page. And you can see, you can choose ahead of time how many phones you want. So it's great for families or businesses. $6 per phone, flat fee once a month. And then you choose how much data you're going to use, how many minutes you're going to use, how many text messages. But do this kind of, you don't have to, it doesn't matter really, because you could pick zero across the board and you'd still pay the same amount. If you pick the XXL, 3,000 minutes, 6,000 text messages, 3 gigabytes of data, and you don't use it, they refund your money. So this is a really, I don't know, you know, this is like the phone company's got, this is Randall Stephenson is losing sleep over this. He ought to be if he's not. So look at that. If you do that plan, it tells you kind of what it would be. That's really what this is for planning. Because in truth, you only pay for what you use for. There's never a penalty. And by the way, included free at all on all Ting phones at no charge. Voicemail, picture and video messaging, three-way calling, caller ID, tethering, and hotspotting at no additional charge. And look at these phones. Great phones, from feature phones to the top-of-the-line smartphones. I would get the Galaxy S2. That's my personal favorite, the 4G. In fact, I use that on Sprint, and it's a great phone. The Samsung Conquer. They even have, very inexpensive phones, basically burner phones. For $170, you can get the LG Optimus S. That's a great Android phone. They say it's not a cheap Android phone. It's an Android phone at a good price. And I'm gonna help you get $50 off if you go to ting.com/twig. $50 off of any of their phones. So pick the phone you like, subtract $50, save money. Only use this what you need and never pay a penalty. There's no waste. It's wonderful. These guys really, I hope they win, because this is exactly how phone service should be. Ting.com/twig. And to enter the contest, ting.com/DYC. You can do both. It's okay.
Hey, Ting guys. Ting, yeah, can you fix hotel Wi-Fi?
Yeah.
Can you fix that problem?
That's next. Right. You know what it is? It's Elliot Noss, who runs Two Cows, and he's fixed domain registration with Hover. He's fixing the phones. I wouldn't be surprised if the next thing is hotel Wi-Fi. Elliot, if you're listening, please. So tell us about PII, Kevin Marks. What is this about?
So it's privacy, identity, innovation. So it's the collection. Jeff, I think, came to the first one. And it's, in some ways, it's the collection of people that Jeff rails against, because there are privacy commissioners, people like that here. But there are also geeks, people from Facebook and Twitter and, you know, me and EFF people. And there are also some lawyers who thinking about privacy policies and things like that. So it reminds me a bit of the Supernova conference, where you would get a group of people, a different sort of group of people who are normally at loggerheads and not talking to each other, and it puts them together for 3 days and gets to talk to each other. Yeah. So it's very good from that point of view. And I've been impressed with the conversations we've had here, because they've been, they haven't been railing at each other too much.
What are the problems that people feel we need to solve? I mean, I think when you say the word privacy, That's the problem, but what are they identifying as the problem?
The problem is to some extent overreach and some extent leakage. That's what they're right. saying. It's like are you correlating things you shouldn't be correlating, and how do we stop that happening? And the debate is, do we make it an offense if somebody collects data they shouldn't, or do we make it an offense if they abuse that data? But the interesting thing, one of the things has been, there's been a lot of public pressure when people discover apps are gathering information that they don't think that they need, and that having those things pushed out in public has actually caused the apps to draw back and think more about what they should be collecting. So that's actually been working better than legislators or even FTC suits in many cases to do that. So the sort of the power of the web as public shame is working better as a sort of privacy restraint in many cases than government action. And of course, the other half of this is that the governments talk out both sides of their mouths, because in one thing they say you can't collect this stuff, and the other thing they say you must collect this and give this to us,
save it for us.
Right, exactly. You can't collect this data, but can you send it to us?
Yeah, we'll take it.
No, wait.
Hey, you could trust us. We're the government.
Right, and there's been bits and pieces like that. So who do you trust more, a large company or a government? And the answer tends to vary depending on whether you're from the US or Europe.
But, right.
Yes, exactly.
Isn't that interesting? It's purely cultural. Yeah,
but it's a weird paradox. When I was in Germany at Republika two years ago, presenting what was then to become Public Parts, I talked about the German paradox, the European paradox, and somebody stood up and said, "Well, what about the American paradox? You've had a better government than we've had for much longer, but you all don't trust government. And we have better companies, better regulation companies here. We don't trust companies."
Yes. So the other thing we're seeing is we're starting to see more of the personal locker type projects and things like that show up, which are, you know, I approve of those. I think those are good ideas. And so some of the startups people have been showing off have been things like that. There's personal,
But Kevin, hold on for a second.
Yep.
The locker idea versus the server of your identity idea. Is the locker just a place to store your own stuff, or is it which Gene has been kind of heading to too, the place from which you can serve your stuff on at your option?
Jeff, we're getting a bunch of wind. If you can position yourself,
Sorry.
It's a bit of both. It, you know, there's both variants of the idea. So one is downloading stuff so you've got a record yourself. There's interesting ideas from a startup called Curious that is trying to do that for medical data. So gather together all the stuff.
Right, I saw that.
Sensors you're attaching to yourself. Yeah. And it's one of the founders of 23andMe, and she wants to correlate that with genetic information and other stuff too. So there's that, those kinds of sort of personal lockers, and her argument was this is a way around this medical privacy thing. Is very actually very hard to gather clinical data for clinical trials because of all the rules about this. But gathering data on yourself is allowed, and if you want to do that and share it with other people, that can work, which I think fits in with Jeff's discussions of sharing his illness in public and things like that. So there's that side of it. There are also ones that are providing an encrypted store that will then fill in forms for you on the web, or will potentially provide an API as an alternative to using Facebook for auth effectively. So you can auth to that using OAuth and feed data into that. And the challenge there is still we haven't all got those standards converged yet, but there are several ones working on that's interesting. So Glyph is one of those. I think SecureMe was one of those as well. There were several different startups showing stuff like that here. And then the other aspects of this that have been, I was on the with big data becomes big responsibility panel discussion talking about the idea, what happens with, you know, with so-called big data, which I was reframing as it's actually messy data, where what the sort of MapReduce worldview comes down to is taking a large amount of messy data and constructing a database out of it that you can use for other things. And that is, you know, the size of the data is not so important as the schemalessness of it, if you like, and the fact that you can reconstruct schemas arbitrarily rather than spending all your time getting the data into the format that you've already decided. You can say, oh, I wonder if I can find data in this format in this pool, and then you write the MapReduce to construct that, and then you've got a database that has that piece in it.
That makes sense.
So there's tension around that as well, because it's the same thing of, oh, you mean now I can run facial recognition over all the photographs that you posted, you know, 10 years ago that you didn't realize that was possible. So there is this problem of the computer in the future getting better at making sense of the stuff it has, and that does make people nervous to some extent. It's, you know, something that Google has said, that Google has been backing away from facial recognition stuff because it creeps people out.
But they're going to end up doing it because everybody else is going to push it forward. Yep. There's an iPhone app called Click. If you take a picture of people, I tried it out. It's amazing. I took a picture of Chad. I didn't even have to take a picture. I pointed it at Chad. It said, oh, this is Chad. Now, it's doing it from my social graph, from people I have already taken pictures of. So I guess
which is the easier case. And you know, Picasa has a good version of that. And iOS has a nearly as good version of that. Yeah.
Right. So but it's interesting because I think what happens is that's nibbling away at the corners, and eventually Google could try to hold the line, but if everybody else ends up offering similar things, Google's going to say, well, we got to give in. And then it's really out of the cat's out of the bag, because Google has so much information.
And Google has got very good face recognition technology.
Yeah, and they know how to do it. Come over here. I'll take a picture of you. Let me see if I can recognize Kevin Marks on TV.
with a
headset on TV.
Now we can start using the ugly.
Yes. App. You want to see you want to see something creepy and scary? It did. So let me take the picture.
Really?
Let me take the picture. And it did it in seconds. See, it says Kevin. It knew immediately that was you. Okay, that's what face recognition looks like. Now, again, don't let me see if it does, it'll do you, Gina. Don't get scared, because this is taking it out of my Facebook friends. If you're not my Facebook friend, it won't.
Of course, why do you need it if you're a friend? But be that as it may.
Well, because what it does is I take pictures at parties. Ah, stop hiding your face. I take pictures at parties. And
I'm going to start wearing sunglasses inside.
And it's already tagged, because that's what you do in Facebook. It thinks you're Lin Fu, by the way. So you're kind of Asian looking. Let's try Jeff.
She has the zen of Asian.
Coming to us from Blurmany, Sydney, Australia. Let's see if I can get... by the way, it also gets smart because it learns. So you can add people and learn about it. This is K-L-I-K on the iPhone.
It's one of those apps where they haven't tested it on women much.
Maybe it only works on guys. You know what? It's only recognized guys so far. And it doesn't recognize you, but you're pretty blurry, Jeff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you moved your head. It said, I know who that is. Let's see. Keep moving your head. Yeah.
What is the name of this app?
It's K-L-I-K on the iOS platform. Click. But I tell you, I want, there it is. I want this. I know everybody, I understand women especially are terrified of the stalking potential, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think that's really an issue. I think that this is going to be valuable. I mean, if somebody's going to stalk you, they don't need to know your name. They just follow you.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you're looking at someone.
Right. And it just helps you know who it is.
Yeah,
no, because that's still problematic. If you take a photograph of someone on the subway and it looks up their name out of the global pool of faces, that's still problematic.
But you know that the government has this ability and uses this ability now.
Well, right? I know the thing is, it doesn't actually work very well for the government's use case, which is finding the one terrorist out of millions of people. But it is quite good at this use case, which is finding the person from the subset of people you already know.
Yes.
Right.
One of the things I think Google did an experiment on this where they trained it on faces of celebrities and then got the defined celebrities in photographs, and that works well because they have a good training set and there's only a certain pool of celebrities, so you can use it for that. But it's not as good at picking somebody you only have one fuzzy photograph of because he's a terrorist and has been hiding his face out of the moving video stream of a camera like that. So. Yeah.
Well, let's move on. Federal judge has learned to code. This big news.
I love this one.
This is a great bit. Love this.
There was a wonderful blog post from Coding Horror said, please don't learn to code. It comes from Michael Bloomberg, who's doing that. I don't think Michael Bloomberg, mayor of New York, really is learning to code, but he tweeted, I'm going to learn to code because there's this new startup, a New York startup that's kind of cool. It does teach you, I can't remember if it's Ruby or JavaScript, but they teach you online. And so Bloomberg signed up for it. Coding Horror points out that it will not help him be mayor in any way, shape, or form. And any time he spends learning JavaScript from CodeYear.com is time wasted solving the problems of...
Well, he's got to look for a new job, so...
By the way, he suggests that when Bloomberg does learn to code, his first program, his only program, will be 10, print, I am mayor. 20, go to 10, which is fairly likely. And he says, and I think this is a good point, can you explain to me how Michael Bloomberg would be better at his day-to-day job of leading the largest city in the U.S. if he woke up one morning as a crack Java coder? Jeff Atwood, codinghorror.com.
Right.
However, it's nice if the judiciary at least understands technology.
Yes.
Which they seem to have a great lacking of so far.
So have you got the quote there for the judge? This is wonderful.
He says, ironically, wait a minute, let me see here. Let me find it. This is from the O'Reilly Radar post by Mike Lucadiz. Judge William Alsup learned Java in the course of the trial. Can you believe that? I'm trying to find the quote here.
I think that it's in the link to it's a Wired and that
it's in
post.
The Wired. He told the court he had learned to code Java for the trial, implying he knew other languages as well. He said he had written some of the infringing code at least 100 times. What? He said... Wait a minute.
So I've got a transcript here. He says, I couldn't have told you the first thing about Java before this problem. I have done and still do a significant amount of programming in other languages. I've written blocks of code like range check 100 times before. I could do it. You could do it. The idea that someone would copy that when they could do it themselves just as fast, it was an accident. There's no way you could say that was speeding them along to the marketplace. You're one of the best lawyers in America. How could you even make that kind of
Wow, David Boies. Wow.
And voice says, I want to come back to range check. And the judge says, range check. All it does is make sure the numbers you're inputting are within range, and it gives them some sort of exceptional treatment. That witness, when he said a high school student could do it.
This is great. I wish I'd been in court during this. Wow.
Wow.
So the point is, you know, the thing that's good about this is not that the judge learned to code, which is, you know, that's good in itself. The point is, it's part of the culture now. The fact that people can understand what coding means and what effort is really, really important, because it means we're more likely to get sensible decisions in cases like this rather than treat it as some kind of magic like Boies is trying to get them to do. And that's the difference between, you know, this, the court cases now and these kinds of lawsuits we've had 5-10 years ago where it was, all this code is pure magic.
That's, Kevin, you're absolutely right. But in journalism, I find this desire to have the mythical journalist coder is going to solve everything. And I think the difference here is that what you're talking about is literacy. The judge made it a standard to be literate about coding, and that's what we really need.
Yes.
Yeah.
On the bench in Congress, absolutely. But they don't need to code. They need to be digitally literate. But I think that a judge who could say, hey, a range check is simple. Anybody could do this. So calling this infringing code, by the way, this is the Oracle versus Google case. Oracle, which bought Sun, which created Java, is asserting that its patents and copyrights were violated by Android's use of Java. But I have to say, I like it that the judge in this case is making these arguments. I think that's good for Google, right? He's even saying, you know, you may not have any statutory damages here, which means you may get zero. You may continue. You may even win this case and get zero, Oracle.
But then you had stories in the lineup that I didn't understand. What's the so Google doesn't pay anything they could afford anyway. If they win the case, though, what is the precedent that this sets? What does it do to the rest of us and other cases?
Well, it sets a precedent that you can copyright APIs, which means they can go around suing other people because their APIs are copyright.
So that's different from copywriting code or patenting code. Copywriting an API saying the ability to interface with my software. And by the way, people have pointed out an API could be something as simple as, hey, give me that web page. I mean, it's very simple stuff.
Yeah,
it's just a way to access the interface with the system.
It could be a GET request as an API.
Absolutely.
So it makes method patents look like kids' work compared to this.
And we're already bitching about method patents. If you could copyright an API and say, hey, GET is ours. You know, you can't. Netscape could say, GET, we invented GET. No other browser can use it without licensing it.
Oi.
That's a good word.
Right.
Even though it totally goes against the whole purpose of an API, which is that people can use it to interface with the system. But this is a question of copying the API. Like, this is about, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but this is because Google created Dalvik, which is a different Java runtime, which mimics all the same APIs that the official Java runtime.
The code within Dalvik probably doesn't, I mean, originally Oracle asserted that the code was copied, but I think that they've lost on that. So now they're saying, well, even if the code wasn't copied,
This is the only thing they found with these 9 lines in the range check, you know, which is clearly trivial.
De minimis.
Right.
So throwing that out now, okay, well, but you copied our interface. But see, that goes back to the earliest days of computing when, for instance, Phoenix copyrighted the IBM PC BIOS to make it possible to make IBM clones. They did it in a clean room environment. They reverse engineered it. They merely made it interface compatible. That allowed the entire explosion of technology, personal computer technology as we know it, that would all be thrown out.
Right.
Right. I mean, in a lot of ways, they were respecting Java's kind of write once, run anywhere. They could have built Dalvik with a completely brand newly defined API. Interface, right? Which would have been insane for Java developers. They wouldn't have been like, what are these classes? What are these methods and interfaces that I'm so used to? So in a way, you know... You know, you want them to respect the interface, but they didn't license it. So that's the issue.
Also, Google's attorney complained because there is a debate over how much money was made. And Oracle said, well, we're going to find out. We're going to call Larry Page and Eric Schmidt to the witness stand for the damages phase. Google's attorney argued it was a stunt designed to turn the case into a Java versus Android battle when only a few lines of code were infringed. Calling the top executives was outrageous. The judge did not agree in that case. He says, the fact that Mr. Big is being subpoenaed, I'm sorry, this is a big case. That doesn't cut much with me. But he did not make a ruling. He said, you guys work it out. He said, I'm busy. You figure it out. I have to say, it does not look like it's going well for Oracle. Is that your sense of it too, Kevin?
Yeah, that was definitely my sense of reading that last transcript. Yeah.
Yeah.
But isn't that the argument, though, that Oracle may win nothing, but we all lose everything?
Well, it would be if this API, if it were allowed to copyright an API. But I have to say, I'm encouraged by Alsip's clear understanding of what's going on. I love it. A judge can say, I wrote a range check. That's not so hard.
It's pretty fantastic.
I love that.
Well, given that they systematically excluded all the jurors who knew how to code, which in Santa Clara County was like a third of them or something, they've now got a judge who knows how to code, which is good. That's what I'm saying. That's the encouraging part for me, is that there is a broader understanding of this stuff now, in the same way that there's a broader understanding of open source ideals because Wikipedia is out there and people understand they can edit it. So that means that we're less likely to get bizarre decisions by courts or even by politicians because they don't have an understanding of this, because people, you know, it is actually more pervasive, this culture. So that's good.
But it isn't over by any means. And the guy who writes FOSS patents, who I think is a pretty intelligent guy, Florian Mueller, and is, by the way, a paid consultant for Oracle, I think.
Microsoft.
Sorry, Microsoft. He wrote a blog post saying that, yes, I am a consultant for Oracle, but the timing is a coincidence. I'm doing something else. In any event, Mueller, take this with whatever grain of salt you wish, says that there's no way Google's use of Java could be considered fair use. I take it that's what Google's asserting. He says it's equivalent to hijacking the platform. Google benefited from the development of Java by basing its code on it, then specifically made Android incompatible. Yeah, if you're an open source guy, this is kind of exactly what open source people hate the most, which is you took advantage of our open source work and then you closed, you know, you pulled the ladder up behind you. He says, on the other hand, George Reese of Instratus Networks says, if APIs could be copy protected, that would be incredibly destructive to the internet as a whole. Not just the internet, technology in general. It would, as you say, have repercussions far beyond the patent problems we already have. Well, we'll see. We'll continue to follow this story. Court cases are so difficult for us. We do have a good show, which I recommend, called This Week in Law, where actual attorneys discuss these issues intelligently. So that's novel. Oh, there's so much to talk about. We're running out of time. Let me just quickly run through a couple of the other top stories. Apple is probably, according to credible rumors, dropping Google Maps for its own in-house mapping with an incredible, quote-unquote, 3D mode.
See that coming.
Yeah, that was pretty obvious. And I don't think... Yeah. I think that's a risky move since Google Maps is the default. But remember, MapsQuest used to be the default. And there are...
Right.
So these things can change.
I'm surprised that Google hasn't tied in more of your personal information into the maps. The more that they brought in our preferences, our history, all that, the more we would be loyal to Google Maps.
Right. Well, they do.
They haven't done it.
I use Latitude. I like to be stuck with
it. I can stick Leo with it.
Yeah, in fact, Kevin and I are the only people who do use Latitude.
Well, exactly.
Actually, the only people who check in on Latitude are people who work for Google. That's really amusing. It says, do you want to check in? I go, okay, I'll check in. It's like, oh, the leaderboard is like
Jeff it is. And it's all Google's. You're right, come to think of it.
So it's funny. But no, but the thing that I found amusing about some of these reports was the people who clearly never used Android saying, and these maps are going to be great, they're going to have navigation in them. And it's like, well, have you ever actually looked at Android navigation and how good it is? I suspect Apple can get away with this. They can make something that replicates the features they've got now, which, you know, basically haven't moved in 2 years, and add something a little bit better. And all the other people go, oh, that's great. It's like when they got added notifications to iOS. But the deep navigation stuff that Google has got will be really hard to replicate without them buying turn-by-turn data from somebody, because right. Google got that by driving all those cars.
Oh, interesting. Google made its own turn-by-turn.
Right. That was the other, you know, the other half of the Street View thing was actually gathering the turn-by-turn data.
I didn't know that. They didn't buy that from anybody.
And they bought it before, and then they realized when they wanted to do navigation, that was the piece that they weren't going to be allowed to do. And after Nokia bought one of the big providers, I can't remember which one it was, that was the other shoe dropping.
There was Navtech and Telenav, and Nokia bought one, and Ericsson or somebody bought the other one. I can't remember.
So that partly led to Google having the, we better get this ourselves because we've got more control over it.
Interesting. And I haven't seen any Apple Street View vehicles.
So. No. So I think they would have to license Nav from one of those others. But the OpenStreetMap stuff is good, and the fact that that's available and that those layers are being supported, and even by Microsoft, is good too. The open stuff.
I love OpenStreetMap, but there's no Nav in OpenStreetMap, and there's no a satellite or Street View or any of that stuff. It's just maps.
And the other thing that Google has on Android, which potentially Apple could do, is each Android that's using Nav is feeding them back traffic data.
Right. There's a huge advantage.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Apple could do that with iPhones. They could gather data that way, but it won't give them you could potentially eventually get turn-by-turn data that way, but you'd have to have something to bootstrap it. And a lot of the terms in the data you buy from people, it explicitly tries to stop you doing that kind of thing. Hmm. Trying to mix data from more than one source.
Interesting. Finally, the Google glasses are now patent protected. Of course they would be. Apparently, not just the glasses, but the ornamental design.
Google owns geeky now.
Yeah.
Ornamental, air quotes.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that means they're serious about Project Glass. It means nobody else can do Project Glass quite the same way.
Amber Case was here, and she had some glasses that really looked like that.
I think we should mock some up and walk around and pretend we know more than we do. Oh, hi, Lin Fu. Wait a minute. reboot.
That is truly the only time in my life anyone's ever told me I look slightly aged.
It wasn't me. It was the app.
It was the app.
Don't blame me.
Okay.
And maybe even the app didn't. I don't know. And by the way, this patent design has the heads-up display right over the eyeball. So unlike the ones we've seen before where it looked like you had to look up, it looks like you really are looking through a screen for this. So whether that's telling, I don't know. All right, we're going to take a break, come back with tips, numbers, and tools. If you would like, Kevin Marks, I will cede my Google tool position to you if you have something you want to talk about. Otherwise, I could let you go if you want to go back to your conference.
Let me see if I can think of a tool.
You think about something while I do an ad, and if you're not there when I come back, I'll know you recused yourself.
Yeah, run away!
I want to talk a little bit about GoToMyPC, the best remote access out there from our good friends at Citrix. Citrix has a great philosophy. Make the product better and better and better. Upgrade. Always be upgrading. ABG. Always be upgrading. GoToMyPC is the best remote access out there. They started with, of course, the brilliant Citrix platform. Mac or PC. They use NAT traversal, so you never have to do anything scary like open firewall ports or things like that. They make it simple to install. So you don't have to call IT and say, I don't understand what's going on. It's so great. It sets up in minutes. And then, by the way, you can leave work. You can go home. You hit the road. You can get work done wherever you go. And here's one of the features just added that I think is so cool. You don't have to just use a computer to access your office computer, Mac or PC. You can use your iPhone or your iPad or your Android tablet. Free apps available. You can use all three. So here's the deal. You want to try it? 30 days waiting for you at gotomypc.com. Click the try it free button. Use the offer code TWIG, twig. Then get those free apps, the App Store or the Android Play Market, and you're ready to go. Hit the road, Jack. You know, anybody calls you up from work, says, "Hey, where are you?" Say, "I'm right at my desk. I'm going to send you an email to prove it." Send and receive email, access any network resource running program with Go to My PC. Try it free for 30 days. GOTOMYPC.com. And then get the app because it's so cool. Gina Trapani, time for your tip of the week.
Just got an email about this today. An app that we talked about a few episodes ago called Schemer, schemer.com.
Yeah.
This is a Google app. It doesn't really quite look like a Google app, but it's kind of a lifeless goal setting kind of app. You log in with your Google account. You say, "I want to climb Mount Everest or learn how to speak French fluently."
It's just a blue icon with a mustache.
Yeah, the mustache icon is great. The iPhone app launched today. I think when we talked about it on the show, you needed an invite. You don't need invites to sign up. There's a new iPhone app that launched today. There's an Android app. And, you know, it's a fun kind of life list, bucket list kind of app. And it's really neat to see what your friends want to do. And it all ties into your Google account and your circles. The app's pretty good. I was playing with it for a little bit before the show.
Does it look pretty much like the Android app? I mean, is it pretty much the same?
Yeah, it does. It looks similar to the Android app. Yep. And it's iPhone only, not iPad. But it looks similar to Android.
You know what I love is it gives you this thing. How many people I've inspired? I've inspired 651 people. I don't know how. I don't know what I did.
That means that people have looked at your schemes and hit the "I want to do this" button.
Yeah,
I had meaning that they want to do that scheme.
My top schemes: install a custom ROM on a rooted Android device. Done it. Visit all 7 continents. I'm missing one: Antarctica. Travel to Norway. Did it. So I only have one left on my bucket list, but I'm sure there's some other ones. So that's kind of cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a fun app.
Yeah, Schemer, free on iOS now as well as on Android.
It's really neat to see how many people are scheming to get on Twit someday.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea. I like it. Jeff Jarvis, your number of the week.
I switched here to get the Opera House behind me, if you can see it there.
Look at that. Oh, it's beautiful. The sun's hitting the Sydney Opera House. That is gorgeous.
I also want to thank you, Leo, for the power of Leo Laporte last night. Only about a few hours beforehand, I said, anybody want to do a Twig meetup in Sydney? And suddenly 15 folks were at a bar. Good time. Amazing what you can do. So the number of the week is 240. There's a story on NPR, which will be on the list, about a pizza guy who used $240 worth of Facebook ads and really tried to learn how to go viral. And so basically he found that everyone on Facebook in New Orleans finally saw his ad.
Wow. Wow.
Pair that with General Motors, which just dropped Facebook.
Yeah, I saw that. They had a $10 million a year budget on Facebook. They said it didn't work.
The thing that this demonstrates to me is the guy with the pizza guy knew that this is about relationships. He had to tweak it. He had to figure it out. Yes. He had to figure who knew whom. The old days, GM, of just saying, "You will listen to our message," are over. And I think that, I don't know if Facebook is good or bad as an ad medium. I don't know. But I do know that old attitude, the GM would show, is over.
Well, I have to say, Scott Monty, who's the social guy for Ford, responded to GM pulling out, saying, "Well, it kind of depends on exactly what you said, how well you engage, what kind of content, how well you do it." He said, Ford is very happy with our Facebook advertising.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was a chance to zing GM or if they really meant it, but I think that's probably the case. Now, I have to say, people pulling out of Facebook just makes me happy because, of course, we provide a different kind of advertising from banner advertising on a social network. It's a much more engaged kind of advertising. So I'm not unhappy to see GM pull. There was some concern around here. What does this mean? Ford's going to pull out from Twitter? No, it's exact opposite, if anything. Jeff, Kevin, I gave you a chance. Do you want to show us something cool?
Yes, I do. I remembered one. So there's now the Turntable.fm app for Android, which is actually really good. It's nicer than the iOS one. If you know Turntable.fm, it's a website that you log into. It's American only at the moment, sadly. And you play music for each other in rooms. And then there are a bunch of rooms you can go to and it'll play music to you, but you can become a DJ and play music for your friends. And what I found is the Android one works really nicely. It works well. And it actually has been a good alternative radio for me as I'm driving the car around. I can just pick one of the rooms out. I pick the ska music channel and click on that and play a nice range of different ska music while I'm driving around town. And so you've got these rooms that are, you know, that are themed, and they but you can also join in and step up and be a DJ. So you can go into the room and you get the little UI that from the website there with all the little animals dancing and stuff going on.
That's beautiful. There it is.
That's very cute.
Now, is it true that no matter what room you go into, it all becomes dubstep eventually?
No, that's the point. Which am I going the wrong way? They're actually curated pretty well.
Good. By the way, the Phenomenauts are coming to Phoenix across the street if you want to come to town next weekend. They're a fabulous ska band. Turntable.fm now on Android. Thank you, Kevin Marks, for being here. Kevin works for Salesforce, but he's also a well-known, very well-spoken advocate for open standards on the net, and he does a great podcast called TunnelVision, available at TunnelVision.tv. Thank you for stopping in.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. Kevin Marks on Twitter and, of course, on Google+. From Sydney, Australia, ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Jarvis, the author of Public Parts. He blogs at BuzzMachine.com, and Google+ is Jeff Jarvis. Nice to see you, Jeff. Boy, that's beautiful. The sunrise in Sydney.
Trying to get it for you. Yeah.
That's gorgeous. Look at that. Wow. Thank you for being here, Jeff.
Thank you all.
Yeah. Gina Trapani's at smarterware.org. And, of course, she's on Google+, Gina Trapani on Twitter, and Gina Trapani. Thank you, Gina, for being here.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for having me. Great show.
And I'm going to wrap it up with a video from Google on how email works. The story of send. If you've ever wanted to know, Google has a very cute explanation for you. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Behind the scenes with Gmail. The journey begins as soon as you press send. This prompts your message to travel through cable or DSL lines to our infrastructure and into our data center. When your message reaches our data center, we protect it with a wide range of security measures, like security cameras, iris scans, and fingerprint scans in our buildings. Your message then enters the networking room, where our equipment sends it to the Gmail servers on our server floor. Our servers work together to process your data, including duplicating your message to create backups.
We read everything you write, and then we put an ad on it. Anyway, that's the story of send. You get the idea.
At one point, they say they keep their server rooms at 82 degrees.
Really?
To save on cooling costs.
Not 70.
And they said, or Googlers, can come to work in their shorts. And, in the video, there's a bearded guy in shorts going by on his scooter.
It's about green. So
and scanning it for viruses. All our servers are shared between our products.
How do I get this
Which
to
means
stop?
We can do more with less. More searches.
Thank you. Goodbye. You can find this if you want to watch the whole thing on their Google Green account on YouTube.com. Thanks, everybody. We do this show every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 2000 UTC on twit.tv. But if you miss it, you can always get video and audio after the fact at twit.tv/twig. Join us next week for another episode, and welcome to our new producer, Chad Johnson. We'll see you next time on Twig.